Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable, a healthy part of your weekly podcast rotation, no matter what the CDC or FDA says. I'm Peter Suderman. I'm filling in this week for Matt Welch, who's off exploring the thrills of international travel during a pandemic. Today, I'm joined by my regular co-panelist, Catherine Mengu Ward, as well as not one, but two excellent guests, Reason Managing Editor Stephanie Slade and Staff Editor Liz Wolf. Everyone say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, well, hey, Liz. So for the first time ever, we have a majority woman panel. We're going to have to change the name here to the Reason Lady Table. And then, obviously, there's me. Happy Monday, everyone.
So we'll today, let you sit with us.
Yes. Thank you very much. So today we are going to talk about COVID's Delta variant, the latest big reversal on masking from the CDC, the big, big, big infrastructure bill that is maybe, just maybe, about to cross the finish line in the Senate, and eventually a reader question about nihilism. It's going to be great. But before we get going, a word from our sponsor. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff is just clickbait and fake news that no one should waste their time on. Imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias. Where good news, as in positive stories, is highlighted so you don't become despondent. And where journalists dig through the news around the world to find you stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkle has come up with. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with 100-plus news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg. And they've created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of-news feed. This service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. If you go now to inkle.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount, so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkle.com/podcast, inkl.com. So I want to set up today's discussion with a little bit of background. The history of government public health advice is a history of error. From salt to saturated fats to cholesterol to the food pyramid, the FDA and the CDC have issued bad advice based on bad science time and time again. If you grew up in the 1980s, like some of the older members of this panel, you probably heard about saturated fats, which occur naturally in foods like butter and red meat, and you heard that they were really bad for you, and maybe that trans fats were actually a healthier alternative. This idea was backed by the FDA and any number of prominent public health organizations. That same line of thinking led people to reduce their egg consumption, which is crazy because eggs are delicious, and to focus more on cholesterol rather than sugar, and replace saturated fats with trans fats, which the FDA eventually decided to strictly limit and regulate because Americans were eating too many of them, in part because health officials had previously urged food companies to switch from saturated fats to trans fats. And the same goes for salt, which the CDC has obsessed over forever, despite scant evidence that it's a major public health problem. If anything, there's actually some evidence that on average, humans might consume too little salt. The science here has often been shoddy, with poor and incomplete studies fueling guidance that is, at minimum, mistaken and, in many cases, leads people to worse and less healthy choices. A couple of salted eggs and fried butter, which, full disclosure, I eat almost every day, is a pretty tasty breakfast, and depending on your particular health needs and requirements, might even be kind of good for you. It's also the longtime enemy of America's public health bureaucrats, which brings us to COVID and masks. Early on in the pandemic, the CDC botched the rollout of the COVID test kits so badly that they actually had to recall the initial round of testing kits. That failure set back America's testing efforts by months, leading policymakers effectively blind as COVID spread throughout the country. Government public health guidance was initially quite down on cloth masks as well. They said they didn't do much good. And yet, within a couple of months into the pandemic last year, there were mask mandates all over the country, fully supported by government public health experts. In May, meanwhile, of this year, just before the Delta variant started spreading, the CDC stopped tracking breakthrough cases. That's the cases where vaccinated people test positive for COVID. Just in time, folks. And just last week, the CDC updated, which is to say they backtracked on their previous masking guidance, which said that which had previously said that vaccinated people do not generally need to wear masks. Now we have the Delta variant, which all current evidence seems to indicate is much more transmissible than previous strains of COVID. And so the CDC says that because of that increased transmissibility, even vaccinated Americans should be wearing masks indoors in most parts of the country. And that, in turn, has already led to policy changes, including here in Washington, D.C., where three of today's panelists reside. The District of Columbia last week reinstated the indoor mask mandate with no exceptions, except maybe if you're the mayor of Washington attending a wedding. So at least for the majority of this group, the CDC's guidelines aren't guidelines. They are now mandates. Catherine, I want to start with you. You live in Washington, D.C.
I do.
You are required to mask up next time you go to the gym. You're also an anarchist. So big picture, do we need the CDC at all?
We definitely don't need the gym at all. That's where I want to start.
Okay.
First principles, important stuff.
Wrong.
Do not go to the gym, masked or no mask.
Wow, that's some health guidance.
That's my health guidance for y'all today. No, we don't need the CDC. I think that we do need a trusted body that could be a clearinghouse for information and perhaps even issue guidance when there are public health crises. The CDC has not been successful in performing that role. Frankly, I think like Bill Gates would probably be the most successful in performing that role. Not
he
like
seems
him
to be
personally
busy right now.
But, you know, like a nonprofit, privately funded, attempting to do this function, I actually suspect could do it significantly better. And I would love to see that. The problem we
so there were
facing
actually academic groups that tried to do some of this last year, and they were blocked by the CDC.
Correct.
Because the CDC says, no, only the CDC can do, say, testing kits, can do health advice in certain cases. They have a lock on a lot of the sort of the infrastructure for disease control.
Did you just come up with a good use for antitrust?
Ooh, bum, bum, bum. No, this is a classic case of government crowding out private actors. Classic, classic case. It is hard to compete with free. The CDC, of course, is not free in the sense of actually costing $0. It costs our taxpayer dollars, quite a lot of them. I think $6.5 billion or something like that last year went in theory to helping communicate about and prevent infectious disease. That did not work. There has been a huge drop in the trust in the CDC in the last year. There was a RAND poll in the second half of 2020 that showed something like a 10% decline, 10%, not percentage points, in trust in the CDC, largely among white Republicans. You can speculate all you want about the politics of that, and people certainly have. But at the very base level, I think the CDC did not do a lot to earn people's trust during those 6 months. And so it is quite right that many people look at their behavior and said, you know what? I'm not going to do what these guys say anymore. I think in general, this is reflected with a real impatience with the idea of following the science and the CDC as the conduit for science itself. Both of the links in that chain have broken down. And we are now on our own without private actors to back up the CDC since, as you rightly note, they got pushed out of the scene.
So speaking of what ordinary people think, Stephanie Slade, you have a background in polling. And for the purposes of this podcast, that means I'm going to assume you know what normal people think and how they relate to the world.
Speaking of two leaps in logic that are not holding up.
So the CDC's new guidance is, by their own admission, mostly aimed at areas with low vaccination rates and high transmission of COVID. And typically, that means more rural areas that vote Republican. Do you think those people are going to listen? Is the CDC's changed guidance actually going to make an impact out of certain demographics in blue cities where this stuff is already holy writ? I mean, is Delta just going to end up being a new thing for left-leaning rule followers in blue cities who are already vaccinated to be paranoid about?
Well, I definitely think there's reason to believe that it will not, you know, that the guidance will not be sort of, that there will not be high compliance in the places where there already is low trust in the CDC and in the government, and where there has been, you know, a struggle to get vaccination levels up. The CDC changing its guidance is probably not going to make that situation any better. I mean, that seems just like kind of obviously true. Doesn't necessarily mean that putting out different guidance is a mistake, though. I mean, if the situation on the ground changes and new information comes to light, then I think we should be made aware of that. And as the sort of province town situation shows, even in a really blue place, you can have a COVID outbreak. Even in a place with you know, high sort of vaccination rates and among people, among a population that you might think would be inclined to be compliant with guidance, you can still have an outbreak. That's a thing we have learned in recent weeks. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with sort of making that information available to people as they are trying to decide how to go about their lives and how much risk they're comfortable with and what, you know, how much sort of, I don't know, how much weight to put on various guidance, knowing what the guidance is based on is pretty important.
I'm glad you bring up Provincetown. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later, so hold that thought. But next, I want to go to Liz Wolf. You are the sole panelist this week representing the great city of New York. You are a person about town who goes out, who goes to bars, hangs out with younger people. Are New Yorkers changing their behavior, like, at all here? Are you? Is anyone you know actually listening to the CDC? Are you wearing a mask right now? I actually can't see you on the computer screen.
Well, so ironically, I feel like I hang out with all the old geezers in the Reason universe, like Nick and Matt and Nancy Rommelman, who've very much been sort of leading the charge of, you know, you can ignore some of this crazy public health guidance. You can decide your own risk tolerance for yourself. And, you know,
so Nick and Matt are not wearing masks, is what you're saying.
I don't think a mask has touched Nick's face in many, many months. I mean, I went to a rave 2 weekends ago. I think there is a little bit of a divide, and I see this on Twitter a lot, between people who live in fancy, bougie, rich person areas like Park Slope, who are maybe a little bit older, who maybe have families and kids that they're looking out for. But there's definitely a very different set of cultural commitments and things that they want to signal. Then you voyage to areas like Brighton Beach, which is, an enclave of tons of Eastern Europeans, tons of Russians. You go to Corona, Queens, which is, you know, was hit very, very hard in the early part of this pandemic. You go to Rockaway Beach in another part of Queens. This is not an area where people are particularly up in arms about what the CDC did most recently. In fact, I would even argue that they're not even super aware of it. So it's actually kind of refreshing to voyage out to outer boroughs of New York or to hang out with young people who are in the obnoxious underground DJ scene or what have you, as opposed to just seeing what blue check marks from Park Slope say. Like, they have a little bit of a warped view of what is going on in New York. And I think it's worthwhile for all of us to take a step back and say, this is a city of 9-10 million people, many of whom are utterly exhausted by this, and many of whom have much healthier, more sane assessments of how they ought to live their lives going forward.
All right. So things are different in different places, even within the same city. And that's useful to remember. One of the places they are different is Provincetown, which Slade, you brought up before. So one of the reasons that the CDC cited for updating their guidance is a case study from Provincetown, Massachusetts, where, as the headlines have been telling us, 74% of a cluster of cases occurred in fully vaccinated persons. But this study has come in for a lot of criticism from a bunch of quarters, notably folks pointing out that Provincetown is a heavily vaccinated area with about 95% vaccination rate. And as vaccination rates go up, the percentage of new cases in vaccinated people is likely to rise too. So, for example, if 100% of the residents of the state of Massachusetts were vaccinated, then you would expect more or less 100% of the cases found in Massachusetts residents would be amongst vaccinated people. So, talk us through this Provincetown study. Why is it important? Why is the CDC using an uncontrolled outlier study to set national guidelines? And why are you mad about it?
I think that there, like I started to say a minute ago, I think there actually is a lot of value in knowing what happened there.
Yeah,
and I would really push back against anybody who suggests that like we shouldn't pay attention at all. Nobody should be looking at the study at all because it might reduce trust in the vaccine. I think that's the sort of manipulative communications that has caused so much of the distrust in the guidance over the whole last year and a half. And so I don't want us to be guilty of that. I don't want us to make that same mistake. There was an outbreak in Provincetown. It was under particular conditions, and those conditions need to be sort of emphasized. If you are going into, if you're considering going into a situation that has some of the same characteristics of a lot of people crowded into one place, many of whom have traveled, when they're going to be mostly indoors and maskless and engaging in what I will euphemistically call spring break behavior.
That's the CDC official terminology, I think.
You're gonna be exposing yourself to a lot more risk, and people should be aware of that. I mean, people should be aware of what is likely to happen there. And I think this is relevant even at a larger level. I mean, just like maybe 2.5 weeks ago, I went into a large giant hotel ballroom here in DC to cover a conference that was happening. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people. It was the International Religious Freedom Summit. So some of them had come from all over the world. And there was this hotel ballroom, and there were lots of people there who had traveled, and none of us were wearing masks. And 2.5 weeks ago, I felt like that was a reasonable thing for me to do. And today, I'm not sure that I would make that same choice. So I do think that having that information is important. That's very different from saying that national policy should be set and that mandates should be handed down, you know, top down, based on what is essentially an outlier situation. The worst case scenario in this very unusual, you know, situation that did cause an outbreak, we should assume the worst. We should assume that therefore this is transmissible. Everybody is a walking potential, you know, case of like spreading death everywhere we go, whether we're vaccinated or not. And therefore it's okay for, say, DC to impose mask mandates suddenly, because I think the important thing is that we should be able to make informed choices, and I want that information so that I can make an informed choice. But I am preempted from doing that when the mayor of DC says, "Nope, no choices are allowed. You will do what I say." I won't do what I say. By the way, she was within hours of the mask mandate in DC going into effect this weekend. She was caught at an in-person large group, you know, indoor event without masks.
She was officiating a wedding with hundreds of guests, and she wasn't just maskless when she was giving speeches. There were photos of her sitting at a wedding dining table in a room with hundreds of people, not all of whom were wearing masks, and she was one of the people who was not wearing a mask.
And we should note that the DC guidelines contain an exemption for DC officials going about official business. Now, I don't think that this wedding was that, but a classic example of do as I say, not as I do. But I think the other piece of this, which is super relevant, is she probably was doing a totally reasonable thing to be maskless at that wedding. And that is because even though we do know that transmission is possible and that there is such a thing as breakthrough cases, the death rates and the severe sickness rates from those cases is extremely low for vaccinated people.
And that's true in Provincetown too.
Correct.
It's one way to look at that case study is, oh my goodness, there seems to be some spread amongst vaccinated people. And another way to look at it is, wow, the vaccine really seems to protect people from death and even from hospitalization in most cases.
And this is what we was talking about a little last week, 2 weeks ago on the podcast was, you know, I do think there's a point where we start having to ask the question, when is being unvaccinated a risky choice that individuals are making rather than, as a general rubric, a thing we should see as a societal risk? And of course, all risky individual choices do have impacts on other people. But at this point, I am vaccinated. And if I want to go to, say, the Columbia Room on Saturday for the first time in a really long time,
which you would want to do,
and take off my mask and drink a delicious cocktail with some chartreuse in it, then I would be making a reasonable decision to do that. And the idea that Muriel Bowser can tell me that that is now a choice that is off the table for me, it should be, I think, seen by libertarians and people who value individual autonomy as problematic, because there's no distinction at some point between me doing that and a whole host of other behaviors that we would like to see legal, even though they have negative individual and societal implications.
A few days ago, Politico's Jack Schaefer had a really great piece that I think you guys all read named "It's Time to Rethink What the End of the Pandemic Looks Like," in which he does, you know, a lot of requisite throat clearing about the threat that the Delta variant poses. But he very sensitively and clearly posits a really important point. It's time to figure out a toleration point, recognizing that some significant percentage of the U.S. population will, for whatever reason, refuse to get vaccinated. But he's talking about a toleration point for what amount of death and contagion level will allow from COVID, recognizing that it might not be eradicated and it may become endemic. The current cycle of sometimes lockdown, sometimes not, just isn't sustainable, and we need to sort of more broadly figure out what amount of community spread is tolerable. Every year, I mean, for example, we have some amount of death in this country from the flu. deaths that are tragic, but not deaths that we shut society down to prevent. So the thing that he's asking is, when will COVID be thought of the same way? And by the way, nobody wants to do this thought exercise. Nobody wants to be the guy who brings this up and says, what's our number? What's our point? But it might be time to think about that. Part of the problem, though, is that we might not achieve consensus, and our public health bureaucrats are incredibly risk averse in a way that doesn't square with the rest of the population. They're outliers. They think about things really differently than we do.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And in fact, if you look at what's going on in the United Kingdom, this is what Boris Johnson is basically saying, is we're going to reopen because we have vaccinated a lot of the population. And we recognize that when we reopen, that increases the risk. But now people have access to vaccines and they are going to be able to make judgments about that risk for themselves. There was actually a useful headline in The New Yorker, not some bastion of wingnut COVID denialism, which just said, an uncertain new phase of the pandemic in which cases surge, but deaths do not, had a very useful stat. Since mid-June, the seven-day average of new cases in the U.S. has grown by 550%. That's a big jump in new cases. But the number of deaths is almost exactly the same. In mid-June, the national seven-day rolling average was about 350. And last week in the United States, it was about 301. So it's actually very slightly down. And this is just a different reality. Slade, I want to go back to you and your polling experience here. Because one of the main things that even casual observers of polling know is that slight changes in the wording of a question can massively shift the responses. So, do you eat salted eggs for breakfast most days might generate a very different response than do you consider yourself a regular eater of salted eggs for breakfast? And so I think this actually applies a little bit to the CDC. So the CDC may be in the don't eat eggs business, but it is not in the polling business. They are, however, in the informing people business. They are as much as a scientific findings agency, also a public communications organization. And it seems like they're not very good at the public communications aspect of the job. So by scaring people about Provincetown, which if nothing else, as we've talked about, is just a huge outlier. Even Provincetown, which in some ways looks good, that is a rare case. That is not what seems to be the norm. And, you know, and then demanding, or at least offering guidelines that say people in most parts of the country should wear masks, even if they are already vaccinated. Isn't the CDC sort of contradicting itself? Basically saying, on the one hand, get vaccinated, folks, so that you cannot go back to living a normal, unmasked life. I mean, aren't they just sort of saying, on the one hand, well, you have to get vaccinated, and also, once you do, nothing will change.
I think the bigger problem is, and this is maybe at this point approaching like beating the dead horse territory, but the fact that the vaccines have not been FDA approved, that they're still considered experimental drugs, I think is more of a culprit. That gives a lot of people pause, I think, when they're trying to, you know, for those who are hesitant, not those who are ideologically, you know, dead set against ever letting, you know, a needle come close to their arm, but those who are hesitant, who say this is all happening very fast, I'm not sure if it's safe. The FDA's choice to you know, do an emergency use authorization and not to expedite the process of getting us all the way authorized, that is a real conflicting message. The CDC, I think, you know, we can quibble, and I think all of us would, with the precise guidance that it has handed down in the last week or so. But I don't think there's anything wrong with the CDC saying, hey, things have changed. 3 months ago, there was a different variant that was circulating than the one that is circulating now. Studies suggest that the new variant affects people differently. We will update our priors accordingly. That's the way this is sort of supposed to go. I think that the jumping straight to, you know, everybody should mask up all the time, whether they're vaccinated or not, and sort of not drawing distinctions is problematic. But it's so much less problematic if it's just guidance and as opposed to law or you know, the mandate is the problem. The force, the use of coercion is the problem. Bad guidance is bad guidance. But, you know, I really don't like this idea that one day it's safe to walk into a store without a mask, and the next day it's not. Like, that's not a good look. But if there is actually if the underlying research has changed, I have no problem with the CDC saying that. I have no problem with the CDC saying, like, we're gonna revise our recommendations. I have a problem with somebody then telling me that, you know, that I must comply in this most rigid and extreme way.
Right. Guidance is one thing. Mandates are another. Guidance allows people to make individual choices for themselves. It provides them information, hopefully good information, maybe not always good information. And mandates don't allow people to make those individual choices. And there's a big, big difference between the two. But a lot of people sort of seem to think there's not. I mean, this is a thing that if you follow the COVID protocol forever warriors on Twitter, they'll just say, well, look, you know, people should quit their belly aching about wearing masks because masking is actually quite low cost. It's easy. At most, it's a small inconvenience. Liz Wolf, you have been tweeting a little bit about that, and I gather that you think otherwise.
Yeah, so I, you know, since I dared to tweet, all of this resulted in a bunch of people flooding my DMs with incredibly absurd photos of people, you know, dead people and people on respirators and all these things. People were treating me as if I'm some sort of like pandemic denialist, anti-mask, anti-vaxxer zealot. None of this is true. This is incredibly far from the truth. I basically just tweeted this past week as the CDC guidance was being handed down that I'm becoming really annoyed by the masks are no real imposition crowd. Yes, they're relatively easy, and yes, they're a low-cost protective measure, but they also take away something really significant from human interaction. For people who are deaf or hard of hearing, for children, this is even worse. For old people who already struggle to communicate and struggle to remember who other people in their lives are, we can't see other people's reactions. We can't hear their words as well. There's so many of the ways that we build trust and friendliness have been eradicated. And so, especially as I sort of assess this, thinking about how we don't really have an off-ramp, there's no exit strategy for any of this, I become really concerned. To me, my exit strategy was get vaccinated. And at a certain point, I do feel as though we're providing people with the means of protecting themselves. And I'm not super convinced at this point that cloth masks are this ultra protective measure that we sort of build them as. They were supposed to be a sort of temporary stopgap measure. And I would direct everybody toward this Atlantic article from January 2021 that just asked the simple question in the headline, why aren't we wearing better masks? This was by Zeynep Tufekci and Jeremy Howard. But they were talking about how in the very beginning of 2020, places like Taiwan and Hong Kong both focused on manufacturing really highly protective masks. I think in Hong Kong, they were patented six-layer masks, lab tested. Taiwan and Hong Kong distributed these to every citizen. Singapore is on its fourth round of distributing, or maybe at this point, many more. But it, you know, it's done many rounds of distributing free, reusable, multi-layer masks with filters to everybody. In Germany, Bavaria has been very focused on regulating higher grade masks. Of course, we're libertarians. So all of this question of how much is the government spending on this? Is this an appropriate thing for government to do? Those are all very fair questions. But the fact of the matter is that in a lot of countries, there has been a concerted emphasis placed on making sure that we're not just wearing these crappy little homemade masks that are ill-fitting around our noses. Because frankly, that's not the thing that will protect people. At least at this point, we have more tools in our arsenal that we should really be paying attention to. You know, it's not just a question of, is everybody around me wearing masks and complying with mask guidance or mask mandates when they're indoors? We should also be really trying to measure what is the actual effect that masks have. Is it just source control? Are these conferring protection for the wearer or for those around them? And I think it's really frustrating that masks have become such an ultra-politicized sort of flashpoint in this discussion. I was really surprised by people's reactions to me just pointing out very basic drawbacks that come with masks, especially because I'm really worried about this becoming like TSA-type measures, where for the next 20 years, for whatever reason, we have to wear masks on airplanes. And we all sort of get around it by like ordering a gin and tonic and sipping it and taking our mask off and glancing around at the people around us and realizing they're doing the same thing. And just recognizing that this is yet another one of those things imposed on high that a lot of us believe can work when they're done well, but are so rarely done well.
Yeah, some of us order a double whiskey on the rocks.
This is also a great example of, you know, maybe this is something the CDC could have done. Seems like in other countries, a CDC, you know, CDC equivalents focused on making high quality masks available and intelligible to their populations while they worked on the vaccine and getting the vaccine distributed. That seems like a pretty reasonable approach, honestly. And the fact that our CDC did all the things in every direction. And this is, you know, if I have one I told you so from this pandemic, it's that on like the first day of us realizing this was really a thing on this here podcast, I said, here's what's going to happen. We are going to open things up, close things down. Before we get the full payoff of things being closed down, we're going to reopen them again. Oops, then we're going to close them again. And we are going to do that. We're going to be at cross purposes with ourselves. We are going to maximize our bad outcomes by trying to minimize them, but doing so half-heartedly and responsibly to political pressures. And that's what the CDC did with the specific question, the narrow question of trying to tell people what to do about the mask thing. They just went every direction simultaneously and got people so hopelessly confused. If you had taken all those resources and just been like, N95s for everyone, here they are, they're in the mail. Like, they have our address because they use that address to take our money in April. I know they know where I live. Like, send me a mask, man.
We also sent people a lot of money.
We sent people checks. We could have sent a mask with each check. Like, again, my preference would not be for the government to do any of this, but my realistic understanding of what our slate of possibilities was absolutely included the CDC fixing on a high quality mask and making those both available to as many people as possible and making the information about them as clear as possible. That would have reduced a lot of the downsides. And I will say, just as a side note to Liz's point about the costs of masks, my poor daughter had her first venture into orthodonture this month. So she is currently...
That's like teeth.
Teeth. She has like a retainer type thingy and she's wearing a mask. I don't know what she said for like the last 3 weeks.
She sounds like Bane.
It's incomprehensible. And it makes her so frustrated and so upset. And, you know, I am not one to argue from like my children anecdote when I can avoid it. But wow, it would be great if she could make new friends at camp when she's already struggling with some new dental appliances by taking off her mask.
Yeah, masks give us all the Christopher Nolan sound mix where you can't understand anything anybody is saying. Liz Wolf, I think, actually makes a very good point, as do you, Catherine, about the social costs of masks. But before we go on, I would just like to add that masks have an economic cost. In particular, they make offices much less likely to reopen. So the downtown of DC is just absolutely dead right now because offices have figured out how to work remotely. And they don't want to bring people back into the office all day if you have to sit there in a mask for 10 hours, not being able to understand your colleagues. There's no point to it. So places that have started to reopen are rolling that back. And that, in turn, is going to be costly to all of those businesses in downtown DC, coffee shops, lunch places, all of those places that rely on office foot traffic. This is even going to be true in New York City, where there is not, as I understand, a new mask mandate in place, but where businesses are going to be sensitive to this guidance. And so this is just going to set back DC's downtown in particular, which is already just dead and struggling, I think, for at least for a couple more weeks and maybe for many more months. Okay, so before we get to infrastructure, let's take a break and have a word from our sponsor. Living in a digital age where your personal data is always under attack, your online privacy seems to be a thing of the past. Did you know there's a better way that you can protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing your private data? Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws are applied. By using proprietary military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other privacy-intrusive laws. Secure email and instant messaging services never seen before on the market today. Away from big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, and Google. Take back your privacy and online security with Secure by going to secure.com. That's S-E-K-U-R.com. Okay, It's Infrastructure Week.
Yay.
Again.
Yay.
No, but this time for real, everybody. It's really actually Infrastructure Week. So after a number of hiccups and hurdles, delays throughout the year, a bipartisan group of senators worked throughout the weekend to finish a 2,700-page draft of the long in the works infrastructure bill. The photo going around of the poor Senate staffer who is holding this giant thing. If you haven't seen it, you should Google it. It's on Twitter. It's just perfect. It's like somebody said, let's print out all of Wikipedia and just kept going until the printer broke. Infrastructure bills are infrastructure. The legislation contains about $550 billion in new spending on roads, bridges, highways, broadband, and water. In theory, all of this is offset through tax hikes, spending reductions, and spending that generates revenue to pay for itself. So that's dynamic scoring. But the good folks at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget think that there are a lot of gimmicks in this bill. Surprise, surprise. Yeah. So only about half of the new spending is actually going to be offset, which means that the rest ends up adding to the deficit. In any case, looks like it's going to pass maybe even this week, at least in the Senate. And believe it or not, the Senate won't even have to use reconciliation, the sort of fast-track, obscure process that allows for simple majority votes on certain budget bills. No, they're going to pass this one the old-fashioned way, with backroom deals, legislative pet projects, and a lot of subpar policy ideas that are in the bill because none of the negotiators bothered to kill them. So most or all Senate Democrats are going to vote for this. And the way it looks right now, at least 10 Republicans, possibly including even Mitch McConnell, will vote for it too. Bipartisanship is back, folks. This is the way we used to do things. Who says Congress can't get big things done? So Catherine, like me, you live in Washington. Like me, you've been hearing sweet, sweet odes to the lost art of bipartisan dealmaking for most of your life. And my question to you, examining this particular infrastructure deal, is bipartisanship a good idea or the very best idea?
I really appreciate that you are just putting down like a stake in front of me every 20 minutes on this podcast, and I will continue to eat them. No, bipartisanship is not good.
The CDC says you shouldn't do that.
Yeah. Again, my nutritional health recommendations include no gym, lots of steaks. And no, bipartisanship is in its recent historical form. It means one of two things. One is people being nicey-nicey to each other at Washington parties. I guess that kind is fine. Like, I would like for people to not be actual assholes to each other's faces just because they are a D or an R. And that actually is meaningful. I mean, we have talked on this podcast and in Reasons pages about the fact that there really does seem to be increased polarization, not just in the country, but in Washington in ways that are poisonous to getting legitimate business done. So I will slightly moderate my answer and say there is the dispositional bipartisanship, which I don't hate. I wish that it was multi-partisanship, trans-partisanship, whatever you want to call it. There should be more than bi-parties, but failing that, I would accept that type of bipartisanship. What is bad is legislative bipartisanship, which is fueled by everyone getting everything they want. That is how we do that in this country right now and have done for the last couple of decades. We just spend more until everybody's got enough that they sit down and shut up and vote for the thing. And that is bad for you and me. That is bad for us, the taxpayers. It is good for getting reelected. It is good for Congress patting itself on the back. It is not good for America being a functional country with high quality policymaking and a low cost government.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically right. I will put in a small word for legislative bipartisanship, as long as it's not about log rolling and about sort of spending more, because it has one quality that can, in some cases, be useful, and that's durability, because it removes the stink of a piece of legislation being just a one-party priority, because what that can do is it means the other side, right, if there's bipartisan legislation can mean that the other side won't spend the next decade or so trying to kill a bill. And the best example of this is the welfare reform bill of the 1990s, which was pretty stable and basically accepted for both parties for almost 25 years. I think there's now less of a sort of coalition to protect those reforms. But those were good ideas and they were stable in part because they were passed on a bipartisan basis. I think any future changes to entitlements especially reforms that might restrain their growth, would benefit politically from bipartisan support. But we're not talking about welfare reform. We're talking about infrastructure. We're talking about roads, bridges, waterways, broadband, right? So, you know, you can get your libertarian podcasts. Somebody's got to fund that stuff, right, Liz Wolf? If you're a professional libertarian, you hear this all the time. Well, who is going to pay for the roads? So, Liz Wolf, I want to ask you, who's going to pay for the roads and who should be paying for them?
I think the thing that really pisses me off about this and this most recent iteration is that we just got done with an entire fucking news cycle of being mad at the wealthy space billionaires and being like, why are they blasting their rocket ships up into space when they should be fixing all the problems here on Earth? Which, like, by the way, is a huge theme in Interstellar. Like, if anybody's seen that, the very beginning scene where the dad is called into the school principal's office, I'm like, that's dystopian, right? All of that aside, though, we're in a situation where we just spent an entire news cycle being super mad at the wealthy space billionaires for all of their utterly wasteful spending that, by the way, is totally their prerogative. But in this infrastructure bill, we're focused on now putting a whole bunch of money from the government coffers into investments in broadband. This drives me absolutely batshit crazy because Project Kuiper and Starlink are things that are being focused on by Elon Musk, by Jeff Bezos, by their respective space exploration companies. Basically, a bunch of our really, really wealthy space billionaires are exploring the potential and having great early success with putting satellites up in space that will enable people in rural areas to have access to high-speed internet that they didn't have before. This isn't something that the government necessarily needs to be working on. This is something that private space exploration companies are already getting started on and already seeing excellent results from. It's really astonishing to me that we're paying attention to things like electric vehicle subsidies and all of these things, and we're trying to devote government money to this type of thing, as opposed to being focused on actually improving our infrastructure and paying attention to, are we spending too much? I fully echo every one of Nick Gillespie's fears about the ever-growing national debt and how it won't be him who's paying for it, and it won't be you guys, and it probably won't even be me. It'll be the generation or two generations or three generations after us who are on the hook for paying for all of this.
Slade, is this just Republican cover for the rest of Biden's agenda? I mean, one of the main criticisms that folks on the right have launched about the bipartisan infrastructure deal is that it's just giving Biden a win without really extracting meaningful concessions, because Democrats have said on several occasions, and Biden once said this and then rolled it back, and it's not clear where his actual position is, but Democrats have said they view this bill as being closely linked with a separate $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill that they do plan to pass through reconciliation, and it's going to be entirely a party line bill, not in any way bipartisan. Now, maybe it won't pass in exactly that form because some moderate Dems like Catherine's fave, Kristen Sinema, have said $3.5 trillion is probably too much, but it does seem like something like that might eventually pass. So what are the bipartisan negotiators doing here, in particular on the Republican side? What's the incentive for them to do this, Slade?
Well, they split the bill. You know, it looks right now that in the near term, the bill that will pass, while being incredibly wasteful and full of things that I'm sure are destined to be eventually described by us as boondoggles, most of the things in this bill can plausibly be described as actual physical infrastructure. And so in the near term, I think Republicans feel like we can call that a win. People actually like it when the government spends money on infrastructure. We might not like it, but you know, most average Americans are pretty cool with that. And I think that Republicans feel like, well, but then we can live to fight another day against the stuff that absolutely cannot, by any, you know, honest description, be classified as infrastructure, which initially the Democrats wanted to include in the same bill, and which has now been separated out into another bill. And it's possible that it will pass anyway, you know, on a party line vote through reconciliation. I have a lot of problems with the way reconciliation is being used these last couple of years, but and going back, you know, obviously going all the way back to the Obamacare debate as well. It's possible that that's going to happen anyway, and that Republicans will essentially, you know, Biden and the Democrats will get everything that they wanted. But it's also, there's also a chance, I think, that Republicans feel like, well, there's a chance we can sort of clock a win for the spending that we think is legitimate for the government to be involved with, and also a win for standing up against the stuff that we don't.
Yeah. So, Liz Wolf, not everything is physical infrastructure here. It's a lot of physical infrastructure, but it's more than just roads and bridges and water. There's also cryptocurrency rules tucked into this bill, which apparently are infrastructure, right? So basically, it says that crypto hubs and trading services have to report every transaction to the feds. Can you please give us the 60-second download on why there are cryptocurrency rules in an infrastructure bill and just how stabby that makes you?
Oh my God, yes. So as Elizabeth Nolan Brown wrote about in this morning's Reason Roundup, basically, lawmakers are trying to enforce cryptocurrency taxes because they think this will help fund all their new programs that they want to spend money on. So New York Times reports that by strengthening tax enforcement on digital assets, the federal government could raise $28 billion over a decade, as estimated by the Joint Committee on Taxation. I mean, this is what, $550 billion of new federal spending on infrastructure. So they're trying to come up with $28 billion of that $550. I really think this will be just a drop in the bucket. And the other thing that they're really not considering here is that cryptocurrency firms are now stocking up on lobbyists to help them shape the coming rules, as the Times reports. It's astonishing how They're going to be make it so that cryptocurrency exchanges are going to be utterly hobbled by this and could even see penalties of up to $250 per customer if regulators and the IRS finds that customers were in any way inaccurate or lied to the IRS or even failed to communicate to the IRS just how much holding they have in cryptocurrency. I mean, Coinbase, for example, has 56 million customers. I think it is absolutely adorable that regulators think that this will work and generate a ton of money for them, as opposed to actually making it so that the entire cryptocurrency industry must be absolutely steeped in new regulations, new spending on lobbyists and lawyers to handle these regulations and to comply with them. What we're doing is we're making an industry that used to be and still has great potential to be the way of the future. We're making it so that it's, you know, bogged down in utterly absurd rules because our beloved legislators think that they can get $28 billion from us. It's quite astonishing to me. And I think we'll see more of this. I mean, we already saw Elizabeth Warren asking Janet Yellen to crack down on cryptocurrency more. This is going to be a huge thing that we're going to be focusing on for the next few months or years. And I, for one, am pretty livid about it.
But if it totally cripples cryptocurrency, that's a feature, not a bug, as far as the people who wrote these rules are concerned, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
That's what Elizabeth Warren seems to want. Yeah. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. It is time now for our weekly reader question. This one is from Joyce from Brooklyn, who writes, I'm a longtime lady listener of your podcast, and I'm always trying to talk my mother into listening. My mother is very into philosophy, so I recently jumped on the opportunity to bring up the roundtable when she started talking about the fine distinctions between nihilism and existentialism. I pointed out there's some overlap with anarchist thinking and that she might enjoy listening to Catherine on the roundtable. Lots of people enjoy it, even non-anarchists. Black, she said, people who call themselves anarchists are just cynics who want to seem cool. I thought that was unfair, to which she quipped, if I can be unfair to anyone, it's an anarchist. Catherine, do you want to respond to this? Joyce asks you for a deeper and more thoughtful response, not just a quip. And she says that if we play this question, her mom, whose name is Rose, if you want to talk to her directly, promises to listen to the entire episode. So are people who call themselves anarchists just cynics who want to seem cool?
Hi, Joyce and Rose. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Listen, I would like to seem cool, but I recognize that that is a long way off for me. I was a philosophy major, but I did mostly political theory and some aesthetics. And so my bona fides on any of this are deeply questionable. So I will start there. There is a lot of overlap between the kind of resurgence of cynicism and anarchism. There's a lot of dudes out there, and they do mostly seem to be dudes, though I'm sure not exclusively, and I would love to hear from the Lady Cynic anarchist community if they are out there. There are a lot of dudes out there who are doing the cynic thing.
Should start a club.
Yeah. Jordan Peterson seems to be involved in some way. And, you know, for those who are just tuning in, this has to do a lot with sort of toughing it out, self-denial, asceticism. The original cynics were seen around begging because they had, you know, eschewed worldly things in order to pursue virtue. I do not see political anarchism as terribly connected to any of those ideas. My anarchism springs from the other kind of cynicism, which is to say that I am just very skeptical about the ability of government to do stuff, and also from a very, very deep commitment to the idea of consent. And I think that a lot of political theory hinges on the ideas of consent of the governed, divine right of kings, something to get you from, hey, I am just an atomized individual bebopping around, to it's cool if other people tell me what to do and threaten to jail or brutalize me if I don't do those things. And the way that I think you get from I am just an atomized individual bebopping around to here are some rules I'm going to follow, or that I personally have to consent to those rules. And there is not a good way to get from that to the way that we do governments. And that's how I end up being an anarchist. But I am absolutely a pragmatic anarchist. I, despite the fact that it comes up on this podcast a lot, really do not go around bringing it up because I don't think it mostly matters. And, you know, I do think that the sort of neo-cynics, they really love to bring it up. They're like CrossFitters and vegans and Nick Gillespies, which is they just want to tell you about their thing that they're doing. I really, really try not to bring up the anarchism thing because to me, it is a rubric for thinking about what to do next. And not a utopia that I spend a lot of time constructing. It is a directional claim. Let's head for a world where the deeply inept and corrupt government officials who have control over our lives have no control, and where I can consensually arrange my life around me in ways that feel good and just. You can start throwing in a lot of other terminology about the non-aggression principle and polycentric legal orders and you know, taxation being theft, and I think
you could start throwing in a lot of terminology.
We should talk about those terminologies, but the places where my anarchism intersects with the philosophical concepts of existentialism, nihilism, or cynicism are actually quite minimal. And so maybe in the end, Joyce and Rose, I have not given you a lot to further your family chats, but I hope that you will give anarchists another chance. We are not all douchebags.
And also the Reason Roundtable. You should listen to it.
Yeah,
every
it's
week.
A good
it's
podcast good. If you like
So I like the idea of people bebopping around, Catherine, because you are absolutely a bebopper.
I am. I do a little bit of dancing in the office.
Yeah,
I'm sorry
it's
to
a
say.
Real thing, folks. Okay, so we're now going to go on to our final segment, what you watching, what you consuming. Let's start with you, Slade.
In keeping with our Lady Roundtable theme, I have been consuming a lot of women's sports at the Olympics. And I didn't choose to only watch women's sports out of some sort of like feminist commitment. I just think our women are friggin' awesome. Like the number of female medal winners in gymnastics and in swimming right now is just a wonder to behold. I'm having a lot of fun watching them. I'm also a huge soccer fan. And of course, the U.S. men's national team did not qualify for the Olympics. But the women are, you know, perennially in contention for a medal. And so I've been enjoying watching them, although they've been a little flat this tournament. But yeah, I've been having a lot of fun spending time watching women compete and do awesome things and not getting nearly as much sleep as I should as a result of it.
Is there a single female athlete whose performance has impressed you the most?
Well, I mean, Suni Lee, of course. That's the obvious answer.
Who is?
She's the gold medal winning all-around gymnast at this Olympics.
Liz, what gold medal products are you consuming this week?
I have been watching The White Lotus, which is a new television series created by Mike White, who also had his hand in the jar of Freaks and Geeks. The White Lotus feels sort of like Big Little Lies meets Bloodline meets biting social commentary about class, but it's still really light and digestible. So you can choose to pay attention to the deeper themes or you cannot. But Mike White is fascinating because he created Freaks and Geeks, which I loved. He's also worked on a whole bunch of weird projects, Dawson's Creek and Survivor and basically other cultural fare that since I'm a douchebag, I'm not super into. But The White Lotus is basically about three groups of visitors to a high-end resort in Hawaii whose fates intersect in strange ways. I learned about it via the Red Scare podcast subreddit because I'm a huge Redditor, by the way. I refuse to apologize for any of it. But people were talking about how...
Never apologize for Redditing.
Yeah, Reddit is crucial. But people were talking about how the 15-year-old teenage girls in The White Lotus remind them of Red Scare podcast hosts, Anna Kachian and Dasha Nakrasova. I think there's a scene where they lament that they're on family vacation and they have no drugs to do before one of them pulls out weed and the other pulls out like Xanax. The other pulls out like Percocet. Somebody pulls out a bong. And the point is they read Camille Paglia and they do drugs and they're snarky little asshole-ish teenage girls. And it adds a little bit of comedic relief to an otherwise pretty slow, complex show. There's also an excellent performance by Jake Lacy, who's been in Girls and the High Fidelity reboot, two really, really good shows. He's superb in this. He plays this semi-entitled finance district rich kid jerk who clearly has issues with his mom and with assertiveness in general. And it's funny because he's on his honeymoon, so his new wife is sort of wising up to it. And it's just fascinating watching their new spouse dynamic play out because there's clearly a ton of tension despite it being a honeymoon. And so as the viewer, you get this really voyeuristic insight into where their heads are at and this deeply uncomfortable sense that you can like sometimes get when you're eavesdropping, so like at a restaurant somewhere or at a dinner party, this sense that you get from new couples when it seems like they quite obviously don't know each other very well and are kind of surprised by what they're finding. But anyway, the show opens with a scene from the end where a body killed at the resort is being loaded onto a plane, and they heavily hint at who died, but they don't say it outright. So it sort of opens with a murder mystery, the same way that Bloodline starts at the end and then tells you the rest of the story. Despite its slowness, I highly recommend it. It's complex, it's fun, there's a lot for everybody to like.
This sounds a little like a modernized Robert Altman movie or maybe like a P.T. Anderson film, right? It's like one of these big ensemble casts of weirdos, you know, all following their own weird path and then bumping into each other, right? There's a sort of Magnolia or Nashville aspect to this.
Well, exactly. And I also love places where, or TV shows where the place figures heavily almost as a character. I mean, this is why I compare it to Bloodline so heavily, because that is really, if you took Bloodline out of the Florida Keys, you'd fundamentally have a very different show. And so this is very much the same because it's taking place at this very like desert, like isolated Hawaiian resort. And I think it's fun that they're sort of playing on these motifs of like a Hawaiian resort is like a place to lose yourself and have fun and drink pina coladas or whatever like touristy cliche things people do. But in fact, it's this place where deeper tensions really unravel and unravel very quickly. And ultimately somebody, you know, is loaded up in a body bag.
Catherine, have you been losing yourself and drinking pina coladas?
I've been drinking beer, and I want to just really quickly say...
Wait, are we going to get a beer update?
Yeah, you're going to get a beer update, because last week I said I was thinking about becoming a beer guy after listening to the Liquid Bread podcast, and I mentioned in particular the Mountains Walking Brewery in Montana. And you guys, I will be darned if by Thursday morning, a special delivery of beer from that brewery didn't show up at my desk from listeners Derek and Katrina. They were in Bozeman. They were listening to the podcast. They hooked me up. We shared some. It's in the office right now. I drank one the day that they arrived. Incredibly delicious, just as hoped. And just like a real, it was like a really a bright spot in a week that was a little tough. And I just really, really appreciate the podcast listener hookup. So Derek and Katrina, thank you so much for the beer. What I'm consuming for this week, aside from the beer, is the book, The Wreckage of My Presence. It is a memoir by Casey Wilson. She has many sources of fame. She was on the show Happy Endings, which I am also watching. She was on Saturday Night Live. She wrote the movie Bride War. No, I forget what it's called. A movie about brides. And she and I went to school together. So I have been avoiding most of her output.
Wait, what school was that?
elementary school, my friend. Elementary school.
Not sailing
and
classes?
High school. Well, so wait for it. So there were five Catherines in my class all the way up. And three of us went to Yale together. Me, Kate, and Kat. But Casey was an additional Catherine. She went to New York. She was always like a theater person. And just like too much for me. And
nothing
the thing
wrong
that is
that.
Great about her memoir, which I finally got her into reading, is that she like fully owns it. She's a self-aware theater person. And that makes all the difference. It really does. She's just like a cool pop culture character who had existed at the edge of my consciousness and also in my childhood. And her memoir is legitimately good, Wreckage of My Presence. And I also, as I say, have been watching her show Happy Endings, which got, it's like, it got Firefly'd. Like, it's like a ensemble cheesy comedy that ran a couple of seasons, got like bad time slots, and then got killed and has like a rabid fandom that's trying to bring it back always and forever. And I think I'm now part of that fandom. And I've like relinquished my slightly grumpy, you know, high school theater person views about Casey Wilson. And now I'm like an unabashed fan. So The Wreckage of My Presence, I read it, but I suspect that actually the way to consume it is the audiobook, which is read by Casey.
So speaking of high school and fandoms, I have been listening to the new Billie Eilish album, Happier Than Ever. And
good transition, my friend.
It's really good. It's really, really good.
Billie Eilish is like a gateway drug to Olivia Rodrigo, though, so be warned.
Oh man, I'm in trouble then. Because no, but like I don't think so, because this is a dark, ironic pop album. It's almost like a satire of conventional top 40, right? It's almost like Lana Del Rey meets Nine Inch Nails, but more playful somehow or another than either. It's snarky, right? It's snarky, and it's also sort of industrial. It's sort of just in its tone and in its vibe. It's also a great test for your biggest and most powerful subwoofer, since I assume you all have several in your homes. You should get out the big one. But no, it's a wonderful album, and I feel like Olivia Rodrigo, who I've only barely listened to, admittedly, she's a little self-aware, right? She knows she's sort of the second coming of Taylor Swift, but she is not doing, she's not making fun of what she's doing in some sense. And Billie Eilish both is very good at what she's doing and also like winking at you that we all know that this is ridiculous.
So this is like the theme of our two recommendations is self-aware theater kids.
Yes.
Okay.
This is like the other reincarnation of like a Casey Musgraves type who does that sort of like self-aware country music.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think it's kind of like that, except a little darker, a little more gothic. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Thank you all for listening. We will be back with more guests and fewer CDC recommendations next week.